Because of listeners like you, Preborn has helped to rescue over 67,000 babies. Your $28 to sponsor one ultrasound doubled a baby's chance at life. Your tax-deductible gift saves lives. Please join us in this mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. It is Tuesday, October 28th, and the Democrats are potentially reaching crisis mode as the shutdown of the government continues almost to a month. And Secretary of Transportation Sean Duffy told Fox and Friends this morning that air traffic controllers are missing a full paycheck because of the shutdown, and that air traffic controllers are not going to get any money. He says, quote, the first day is hard, but the second day is even harder than that. And the third day, because they have gas, they have childcare costs, et cetera. And so he also was saying that he can't guarantee that flights will be on time or that they won't even be canceled. And meanwhile, the EBT stamps and food stamps are set to not be able to be used as of, I believe, today. So a lot of actual practical consequences for the Democrats continuing to not vote for that clean continuing resolution that Republicans have introduced over a dozen times now. So where exactly are we at in this process? Well, let's welcome in Congressman Tom Tiffany from the great state of Wisconsin, one of our favorites here on American Family Radio Network. Really appreciate it, Congressman. So where are we at in the negotiations, and are Democrats budging at all?
Yeah, things have not changed, but I do think that they may be changing. When you look at the story yesterday morning, which I think you carried, Jenna, in regards to one of the federal employee unions is saying, hey, Democrats, pass this continuing resolution. I think they're under tremendous pressure at this point. We did our job over a month ago in the House. We passed a clean continuing resolution, and we have repeated this ad infinitum, but it's the truth. We passed it, and Chuck Schumer and the Democrats have decided to play politics with it, trying to extort another $1 trillion. Now, there's a variety of things that are in there, and you've heard them all in regards to they want illegal aliens to get taxpayer-funded health care, as well as those who are able-bodied. To me, it's a very simple thing. Chuck Schumer was asking for another $1 trillion worth of spending in order to be able to pass this continuing resolution. In other words, he was extorting the American people. And we can't just be printing another $1 trillion. It's the reason why a dollar 5 years ago was worth 80 cents now. The inflation is still being wrung out of our economy that has been in place for the last 5 years through the Biden administration. And one of the only ways that we can fix it is to stop the deficit spending. So we are doing the right thing here. I give Speaker Johnson enormous credit. He has stood firm, and he should continue to stand firm until the Democrats come to their senses. And by the way, Jenna, a majority of members in the United States Senate want to vote for this. There's been up to 55 votes for it. Just do the cloture process that needs to be done, Chuck Schumer, and then let's have the vote and let the majority win as it should here in America.
Wow. Well, you know, when you say Democrats coming to their senses, you know, I'm not sure that that's going to happen anytime soon, hopefully on something like this. But where do you see this stalemate actually resolving? Because I don't think the leadership of the Democrats are necessarily seeing changes unless they start getting the blame, and rightly so, for the shutdown, because they're the ones that aren't voting on the clean continuing resolution, which, frankly, I thought was very modest of Republicans, who do have the majority in both chambers, obviously not the 60 vote threshold that's needed in the Senate. But, you know, in my opinion, initially, Republicans could have pushed for more. But to offer a clean continuing resolution so that the negotiations and the back and forth can take place while the American people are still having these essential services funded, that seems to be something that the Democrats would have thought was a gift. So, you know, where do you see potentially the cracks starting to come, or where should they come?
Because we have stood on principle consistently, as you just said, this was a simple single subject bill that we passed with the continuing resolution just to be able to complete the appropriations process over the ensuing 7 weeks. I mean, it's very simple to explain, whereas Chuck Schumer and the Democrats have had to basically changing arguments that they've made that I think is confusing to the American public, including saying things like, you know, something bad may happen and that's going to bring people to the table. Why would you wish something bad on the American people in this gambit that you're doing? But I just wonder if their calculation at this point is the elections that are coming up first Tuesday in November. What would that be? Just a week away, I think, Jenna. Mm-hmm. I wonder if their calculation is that we're going to win the Virginia and New Jersey races by playing politics here. And then after that, perhaps they will relent. I'm not sure if that's the case, but it wouldn't surprise me a bit that they're just playing the political game rather than trying to get good policy for the American people.
Which, and I'm speaking with Congressman Tom Tiffany from Wisconsin, and Congressman, this is what is so frustrating, I think, to people, even on both sides, who we elect people to go to Washington to actually do a job, and then they sit there and play politics instead of actually serving the American people in the capacity to which we sent them to Washington for. And in no other industry would that be tolerated. I mean, those people would be fired. And yet, election after election, while conservatives are saying, you know, vote your values and vote for people who will actually put in good policy and all this, it seems like we're still at a stalemate even with elections in America, where thankfully President Trump won by a landslide. But if you look at the composition in, you know, a lot of states, I mean, thankfully my home state of Florida is, you know, very conservative now because of our governor. You have a few other states. And then, of course, you know, you have the outliers like New York and California that are, you know, way swung the other way. But overall, if you look at the composition of America, the population is very divided still because of things like what the Democrats are pushing for, where a lot of people do believe that illegal aliens, you know, should be here. We should open our borders. I mean, look at the totally irrational people at this No Kings protest a couple of weekends ago. That's what we're dealing with. And so what will it take, in your view, to kind of wake up the American people? Because elections are really what matters. We wouldn't have this shutdown if we sent rational people to Washington.
By the way, those No Kings rallies, it reminded me of a cross between the people attending it. Grumpy old men and golden girls appeared to be most of the people that were attending those No Kings rallies. And just aging
so
boomers out there.
It was cringy
doing their
for
walk
sure.
In the park. But I think that change politically in America is generally incremental. That's our history over 250 years. But I think it was a significant increment a year ago. And there are good things that are happening. And to your point in regards to what, you know, illegal aliens have really been at the center of this, whether it's voting or getting public benefits, stuff like that. I think most of the public, including a lot of Democrats, are very supportive of these reforms that are being put forward, call them the 70 and 80% issues. So I think that there is good things happening on that front. Now, we just need to continue to be persistent and make sure that we only count those who are legally here in America when we do the next census. And also that we do hold our state's feet to the fire that you can only register people to vote who are here legally, because most people are with us. I think that's a 70% issue. And if we continue to push that and get reforms that are appropriate, I think people are going to find that states like California probably have five more electoral votes and five more House of Representatives seats than they should, because they've been counting illegal aliens. We need to just continue to be persistent on that front. And I think we can ultimately win the day. It's frustrating for a lot of us, but I think we need to just continue to be persistent and we'll win the day.
Well, and that persistency will probably extend only so long as the American people continue to be with you in terms of understanding what's going on with the negotiations and saying, you know, principle should carry the day. And you know, rather than caving to some of these ridiculous demands from the other side. But meanwhile, you know, I think a lot of people have questions as well. Why some of these services that we would consider essential, like air traffic controllers, that seems to be pretty essential to me, aren't being funded in the interim. And there are some suggestions from, you know, really just brazen Democrats. I was looking at your X feed and you responded to one of them, which is Senator Tammy Baldwin, who posted a CNN article saying the Trump administration won't use contingency fund to pay November food stamp benefits. And so is basically blaming President Trump for the shutdown. Meanwhile, you know, she's one that's voted to continue the shutdown. So she's not blaming herself. Instead, you know, instead of just pass the clean resolution, why do we need to go to the contingency fund when we could just have the clean resolution and then continue the negotiation? So I don't get that that split logic there. But again, it's a Democrat. So, you know, there you go. But how many of the American people are buying this?
Yeah, I don't, you know, I think the American people view it as a pox on both houses. I mean, you see the favorability numbers of members of Congress, and it's not very high. And this is why they're like, well, why can't you come to an agreement? But that's also why we're standing firm on this. And I give Speaker Johnson a lot of credit. We are doing the right thing here. We passed a clean continuing resolution. It's a single subject bill. It gives us time to finish the appropriations process. And it is Democrats who have said, no, we're not going to do this. We're going to require something in addition in order to pass this. We could have done the same thing, as you mentioned a couple minutes ago, Jenna. We could have larded up this continuing resolution with all kinds of stuff. I could think of a few things that I would love to have in that bill. We were disciplined. We did not do that. It was not in the interest of the American people. We did the right thing. Democrats should do the right thing also and pass this continuing resolution. And I think the pressure is going to continue to build on them to do the right thing. And I hope the American people apply that pressure to them.
Yeah. And last question for you, Congressman Tom Tiffany, in just the last few minutes we have with you. Do you think that maybe starting with the continuing resolution being clean maybe didn't give Republicans enough negotiating room? Because if you had started with a few of those things that would have been incredibly beneficial for Republicans that, you know, maybe Democrats would have absolutely objected to, that then, you know, going to a clean resolution might have been a compromise then for both sides. But starting out with that, you know, other than obviously showing that it's the Democrats at fault here, doesn't really give Republicans anywhere to go except to give Democrats something that they want eventually or waiting for them to crack. I mean, it doesn't seem like there are any other options.
Yeah, so we can always Monday morning quarterback that type of stuff. But I just think that we did the right thing. And I think Speaker Johnson made the right call here to say to the American public, this is going to be a single subject bill. It's something that the American people, I hear from them all the time saying, don't be putting all kinds of riders and stuff on bills. Do single subjects. We did it. We went to the American public and gave them the reasons why we did that. We need seven more weeks to get through the appropriations process. It all, to me, is simple and makes sense. And I think that was the best approach, and I continue to agree with it.
All right. Well, I really appreciate you coming on and sharing what is going on in Washington. We will, of course, be praying for the negotiations and for everyone on Capitol Hill, including you, Representative Tom Tiffany. And for listeners, you can follow him at Rep Tiffany on X. I'd encourage you to do that because you'll get a lot of great news from his feed as well. So, Congressman, thanks so much. And we'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. Well, meanwhile, in the Senate, there is going to be a hearing today on political violence, and Daily Wire's Michael Knowles will be there to testify as someone who was himself a target of political violence. And so that will be later on today, and we will keep you updated on that story, but just wanted to mention. In addition, the Commerce Department is looking at imposing tariffs on the healthcare products that healthcare professionals and average Americans alike depend on for work and quality of life. And so these products include everything from surgical masks and gloves, known as PPE, as we all figured out and recognized during the COVID disaster, to medical equipment and devices like pacemakers, hearing aids, and stents. So the decision could be made as soon as next month as to what the tariff would be, how many products would be impacted. And so Tommy Aiello is the Senior Director of Government Affairs at the National Taxpayers Union, and he is here to explain what we know about the tariffs and why these may be placed. So good morning, Tommy, and what is the Commerce Department thinking exactly?
Hey, good morning. Thanks for having me. So as you mentioned, the Commerce Department, they're looking into whether they want to hit new tariffs on all of the goods and much more than what you mentioned. And their rationale is there's a national security imperative to produce these things here in the United States. Unfortunately, the way they're going about it with these new tariffs, as we've seen on other products, it's going to raise the cost of these products when they reach the United States. And I think when you think about it right now, people are receiving their premium increases in the mail, and they're very concerned about the cost of healthcare. If you were to tariff these really important goods that Americans rely on to remain healthy, you're going to raise their costs, and it's going to raise the cost of healthcare even further. So this really is a kitchen table issue for millions of Americans.
Yeah, and so on what basis is the department determining that import levels of these products threaten or impair national security? I mean, I get that President Trump, and you know, even in his first term, taking back manufacturing domestically, all of that it was a huge priority for him and still is. But that doesn't translate to suggesting that somehow this is a national security issue if we don't place a tariff just to push manufacturing to the United States.
Yeah, he's using an old law that would allow him to do this. And I think the president is right, and you said it too. We want to produce more things in the United States, whether it is masks or pacemakers or steel or whatever it is, right? I think every American would agree that we can and probably should produce more in the United States. We just don't think tariffs are a strong way to get there. Instead, we're urging the administration to do three things to actually increase American manufacturing. One, energy dominance. One of the largest input factors for a factory is electricity. He should continue to produce more oil and gas on federal lands to allow more oil and gas to come to the market. That will lower energy costs across the board. Two, tax certainty. His One Big Beautiful Bill includes so many great provisions for working class people and for businesses. The business provisions will allow companies to immediately put their capital to work. That's a really great thing. And three, permitting reform. It takes way too long for environmental reviews and permitting for companies to build their factories at the state and federal level. Let's cut the red tape and allow all these products to roll off the line at a much faster pace than they are now.
Yeah, and all of that actually makes sense. And so what is the rationale for not just pursuing some of these incentives and pushing for manufacturing to return to America's shores instead of placing a tariff, which ultimately would be the cost would be at the expense, really, of the American people. I mean, it seems like, again, I can't connect the dots between the rationale here why the tariff is where the Commerce Department is going if the end goal is manufacturing in the United States.
I think the administration, they want to just try and tariff everything and use it as leverage, but that's not the best way to go about it. We're hearing from businesses large and small that rely on these affordable, accessible products, and that's what they are. You know, the United States, we produce things at a more expensive cost than other parts of the country, particularly in Asia. So when those goods come to the United States, hospitals and consumers and patients, they can rely on these affordable products. But if you were to tariff them, you know, hearing aids, for example, can cost between $5,000 to $7,000. If you were to impose a 100% tariff on those hearing aids, American consumers would bore the actual cost of that, right? That 100% tariff would cost, you know, hearing aids $14,000. That's a lot of money. But, you know, the president says foreign countries pay the tariff. I think we can agree that that's not true. In some cases, they pay part of the tariff. But when those goods come to the United States, it's the importer that pays it. They pass it along to hospitals. The hospitals pass it along to the insurance companies. And the insurance companies pass those costs on to consumers. But at the end of the day, there's no one for the consumer to pass the cost on to, so they are the ones that have to eat it. And I think that's what's really lost in this conversation is how does it impact consumers?
Yeah, and I think that that's really where you know, the conversation would go next when, as the congressman Tom Tiffany, who was on in the previous segment, was relaying that, you know, Americans are still suffering over, you know, the Biden inflation that, you know, is dropping but is still there. A number of other costs, and now with the government shutdown, I mean, so many other factors that come into this. Now, if this type of tariff were to be passed, then that would be yet just another issue, especially on goods and services that really are essential. I mean, these aren't luxury items. These aren't things that, you know, are maybe a contemplation that people can pick and choose or take or leave. These are things that would be essential items. And so the Commerce Department, at least in the Federal Register, has had a notice for request for public comments. I'm sure that, you know, a lot of the organizations such as yours are, you know, putting in some of those comments and so forth. But you know, that's almost a pro forma kind of measurement. I know that those, you know, often don't really have that much of an impact. What would have an impact in terms of the Commerce Department maybe looking at changing their strategy here?
I think there's two things, and I think the congressman is exactly right. You know, inflation is still high. It's definitely lower than it was when President Biden was in office, and that's a testament to the work the president's doing. I think the data shows that tariffs increase costs, and that's why inflation is as sticky as it is. Now, what would cause the Commerce Department to change course? One, I think it's hearing from actual people, hearing how this would impact them. Even though the comment period has closed, you can still send letters and you can still make your voice heard. And two, I think what's really going to change the mind of the administration in this whole tariff conversation is how is it impacting businesses? Right now, we've lost manufacturing jobs every single month over the president's second term. Now, why is that happening? We believe it's because of the tariff situation. I think if we were to solve the tariff situation, whether through the Supreme Court or these trade deals that the president is negotiating, it'll give our businesses a little bit more certainty that they can invest in the United States. They can produce these goods at an affordable cost, maybe not as affordable as a foreign country can, but that's okay. We don't need to produce every single thing under the sun. We're 4% of the global population. It's okay to import, you know, rubber gloves or face masks, or they can come in at an affordable cost for everybody to enjoy. It would allow the United States to produce other things that other countries can't do. And that's the best thing about comparative economics. Everyone has a comparative advantage. And in this case, perhaps we should leave it to foreign countries that we can rely on.
Yeah, and has there been a coalition of, you know, healthcare system stakeholders, like, you know, hospitals, device manufacturers, distributors, and all of this to assess the operational impacts of of tariffs? I mean, not just necessarily the cost, but, you know, there would be an operational increase as well. Are they involved as a stakeholder?
From what we've read through some of the Commerce Department's comments that have been filed so far, it's pretty, you know, widely agreed across the board, including the American Hospital Association and some device manufacturers, that they're all saying they wouldn't be able to source things in the United States overnight. You can't flip a switch and expect all these things to roll off the line and have it at the same cost as it was previously. So I think what they're concerned about is if a new tariff is imposed next month, what are they supposed to do? And how are they supposed to go about either finding a new supply chain or how do they, you know, manage those additional costs? So you're seeing it across the board. It's pretty widely agreed upon from the medical community that this is going to have an adverse consequence, not just for their business, but for the patients that they so diligently support.
And I'm speaking with Tommy Aiello, Senior Director of Government Affairs at the National Taxpayers Union. And I want to pivot topics here in the remaining time I have with you, Tommy. And talk also about good housing policy that would potentially make housing more affordable for working class Americans. It's been really interesting to see how much emphasis has been on the statistics here of how few Americans are actually able to afford their first home, and how the average person is well into, you know, their late 30s, if not into their 40s, before they're able to purchase their first home. And, you know, this in my view goes, you know, well beyond just the quality of life and ensuring, you know, affordable housing for, you know, all of the benefits to family life and so forth. But it also gets into a bigger picture here of how the Democrats are trying to push for a bigger government system in terms of having more and more people dependent on welfare, fewer people actually owning their own land, their own property, because when there is ownership, you then feel a greater sense of responsibility for it, among other things. And so, you know, a lot of this, if we don't change the housing policy and we don't look at this, is, in my opinion, just feeding into kind of a gift, basically, to the Democrats to continue some of their operational metrics. And so there's a piece in Newsweek that's titled, "The U.S. Housing Market is Falling into a Deflationary Vortex," an analyst warns. And the U.S. housing market is currently in a disinflation and deflationary vortex, according to a real estate analyst who is an analytics platform app founder. And so he's saying that home price growth on the national basis has slowed to basically flat year over year. And now home prices are declining in almost half of the states. So meanwhile, rent growth has slowed to its lowest level in 14 years, indicating that we are just seeing inventory pile up across the housing market. That may be good news. I mean, I don't think that's true for my home state of Florida, where so many people are moving in that, you know, housing is going up, and definitely cost of housing is going up. But overall, your perspective on policy here in terms of the housing market?
Well, I love the conversation we're having today, because there's nothing people think about more on a monthly basis than the cost of their health care and the cost of their housing. So it's really fundamental conversations that we're having that so many people, including myself, worry about on a monthly basis. And I think what we're seeing right now with the drop in interest rates, down about a point since President Trump took office, every drop in a mortgage point, Americans can save $200 a month. That's a lot of money for the average American family, for anybody, right? $200 a month. That could be gas in the car for 2 weeks, a week's worth of groceries, just from doing nothing, just from having that slight change in federal policy. So that's why it's so important that the president continues to push for lower rates across the board. There's another potential rate cut on the horizon tomorrow and in December. So hopefully that'll continue to put downward pressure on prices. Now, I think when we talk about housing supply and how do we increase it, it's a tale of two sides of the country right now. You have Republican states like Texas, Florida, and Tennessee that have reduced these barriers to build. And what you've seen, especially in Texas, as people have moved there, is this huge flood of supply of new apartments, affordable housing. Rents in Austin are down 18% over the past 2 years. That's a great success story. in places like Los Angeles and California, it's still way too expensive to build, and that translates into higher prices for people. Prices haven't come down in those areas. They've only gone up. So it really is a tale of two sides of the country, unfortunately.
Yeah. And so, you know, how is all of this then potentially going to impact the midterms and the elections? I mean, when we have this, you know, stark contrast that we keep talking about, but it seems like, you know, the average voter doesn't necessarily see that contrast of the tale of, you know, two sides of the country, as you're mentioning. You know, how can conservatives leverage this for the midterms?
You know, I think everything comes down to the high cost of living and making things more affordable for people. And that's a point that we need to continue to hammer home, right? The One Big Beautiful Bill included thousands of dollars in tax cuts for working class people. That'll make it more, they'll feel more secure in April when they file their taxes, when they get a huge refund. That's a great thing. Second of all, you know, housing, we need to continue to build affordable housing for people. The private sector, not the government, obviously. But the federal government still has a role. There's this really great bill by Congressman Mike Flood of Nebraska. He's a conservative champion for housing policy. He has this great bill that says if localities want to apply for affordable housing money from the federal government, they need to show how they're reducing barriers to land size use, reducing barriers to building affordable housing. He doesn't want that money just to go to these localities and they squander it. He wants to know how you're spending this money to actually increase affordable housing. It's a great bill. We're proud to support it. And I would encourage all your listeners to look into it, too, and urge your member of Congress to support it.
Yeah, that's a great piece of legislation. And so it's the Identifying Regulatory Barriers to Housing Supply Act, which I believe, do you have the House bill? I think it's House Resolution 4659. So the Identifying Regulatory Barriers to Housing Supply Act, introduced by Representative Mike Flood. And so, you know, that's an action item. If for all of this conversation, if listeners are saying, well, what can I do between the government shutdown, you know, all of this going on, you know, this is something that you can urge your members of Congress to look at as they're contemplating the shutdown. But really appreciate it. Tommy Aiello, the Senior Director of Government Affairs at the National Taxpayers Union. Really appreciate your excellent commentary on all of these things that we really do need to pay attention to, because you're right. I mean, food and healthcare and mortgage is everything that we're concerned about on a monthly basis. So we'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. We're living in a time when truth is under attack. Lies are easy to tell, easy to spread, and easy to believe. But truth? Truth is costly. And nowhere is the cost greater than for mothers in crisis. When a woman is told abortion is her only option, silence and lies surround her. But when she walks into a preborn network clinic, she's met with compassion, support, and the truth about the growing life inside her. That moment of truth happens through a free ultrasound, and it's a game changer. When a mother sees her baby and hears that heartbeat, it literally doubles the chance she will choose life. Preborn Network clinics are on the front lines, meeting women in their darkest hour, loving them, helping them choose life, and sharing the truth. Friend, this is not the time to be silent. It is the time for courage, for truth, and for life. Just $28 provides one ultrasound and the opportunity for a mother to see her baby to help her choose truth and choose life. Please donate today. Call #250 and say baby. That's #250 baby, or give online at preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. Well, as the federal government continues to cripple along and hobble along, the Florida state government is just having win over win over win and is truly the model for other states. And I'm just so proud to live here and be a Floridian and see all of the wins from our executive branch. And Governor Ron DeSantis posted on his social media yesterday that Florida continues to lead the nation in civics education. education under the leadership of Governor DeSantis. Florida has become the national model for civics education, ensuring that every student understands the principles of the founding, what it means to be an American, and how to engage as an active and responsible citizen in your community. And so they've introduced a civic literacy assessment for all high school students enrolled in U.S. government courses, revised K through 12 civics and government standards for full implementation of civics instruction across all grades and subjects, created the Civic Seal of Excellence endorsement, allowing teachers to receive training and a stipend to encourage informed instruction on civics and founding principles, provide regional civics literacy directors and coaches to enable in-person school visits, personalized coaching, and professional development for educators, and also require all post-secondary students entering Florida state universities or colleges to demonstrate civic literacy competence. This is all just foundational for sure. And then also the Florida Civics and Debate Initiative, or the FCDI, was launched to encourage student debate and civic discourse in Florida's classroom. This is in part, the governor said, to honor the legacy of Charlie Kirk. So there will be the Charlie Kirk Prize. Students participating in this competition will now also be competing for a grand prize of a $50,000 scholarship. All of that is so great. As listeners know, I was homeschooled all the way through. I participated in a speech and debate in high school, and then also went on in college to participate in speech and debate. And that really set me up well in terms of just analytical thinking, be able to hear your opponent and actually respond to those arguments and actually have a robust debate that is a free exchange of ideas. We need to be doing more of that. And so also continuing in the legacy of Charlie Kirk, yesterday TPUSA students announced big news. Governor DeSantis just announced a partnership with TPUSA to launch Club America chapters across every high school in Florida. And Florida's Commissioner of Education, Anastasios Kamoutsis, warned anyone who blocks a student or teacher from starting a chapter will, quote, be met with the full force of the law. So the commissioner joins us now, and so much that is so great coming out of Florida. So congratulations on just being awesome. And I am so for all of this. And so let's start first with TPUSA launching Club America chapters across every high school. There was just an article yesterterday that another state school was not allowing a TPUSA chapter to be on their campus. Not going to happen in Florida.
That's right. And thank you, Jen, for having me this morning. It's always great to be here. I appreciate your enthusiasm and your attention to this very important stuff that we're doing in the state of Florida. I'd be remiss if I didn't begin by thanking our extraordinary governor, Ron DeSantis, for his leadership and his steadfast commitment to strengthening civics education in Florida. Specifically with Turning Point USA, you saw both myself and the Attorney General, James Uthmeyer, put out some pretty strong statements to that end. We do believe that it would be a discriminatory basis for a student who seeks to start a chapter to not be able to do it based on their views. But what's even more interesting when it comes to Turning Point USA is that it truly is a speech and debate club. And so to suggest that a student would not be able to open up the club or to try to prevent a teacher from being a sponsor of that club, we believe would be discriminatory, viewpoint discrimination, simply because of Turning Point USA's sort of political leanings. At the end of the day, they do align with our state standards as it relates to open dialogue and civil discourse. So when I made that statement, believe me, it's not just me who's going to be there on the front lines, but we have the full support of the Attorney General's office to ensure that no teacher and no student is discriminated against on the basis of trying to get a Turning Point USA chapter up and running. I will say I've had great conversations with our superintendents throughout the state, and the reality is, if there is pushback, it's not at the district level. All the superintendents understand they are in the free state of Florida, and this is not one of those hurdles or obstacles that they want to be engaging in. They understand the idea of speech and debate and how it helps students grow civically and be virtuous citizens in our society and maintain our constitutional republic, which is what the whole education system really is about. And so it really, when you see these one-off situations take place, which have happened in Florida, it's typically a principal or maybe a teacher who misspoke or didn't realize that, you know, they were making a mistake by trying to block that from happening. And we've immediately addressed it if such a scenario has occurred.
And that's great because, as I mentioned, speech and debate was a part of my formative years as well. And I think really gave me an appreciation for, when most people think of, argumentation, they think of just quarreling or, yelling at each other, but that's not what good argumentation should be. And there are principles to that. There are ways that you can analyze things. And students in Florida, really everywhere in the United States, students everywhere should learn the analytical skills to actually think critically and think through policy arguments, think through worldview arguments, think through all of these things. And it's so fascinating, Commissioner, to me that the left accuses the right so often of being the ones to, indoctrinate students simply because, we come from a biblical worldview basis. But really, the biblical worldview and the conservative view is think through all of these things for yourself. And if you think rationally, we believe you'll come to the correct outcome. And so more speech, more debate is better to then convince you. And that's what Charlie Kirk was all about.
That's exactly right. And quite frankly, that's what the Civics and Debate Initiative is about, which is why we thought it was fitting for an initiative that its central mission is civic discourse and respectful debate, that, Charlie Kirk modeled that every time he had an open forum at a college campus. He encouraged folks of different views and opinions to come and try to prove him wrong, to debate respectfully. You saw so many folks who did not agree with Charlie's position say that he still was respectful in the way that he engaged in dialogue. And so that is what we're trying to encourage our students to do. That's why I think it's fitting that we named the award after Charlie Kirk. The last time I came on your show, it was unfortunate. I had to talk about what we were seeing some teachers say as it related to the immediate aftermath of the assassination of Charlie Kirk killed at a school campus. And this is what we're trying to do to combat that. We don't want students to think that it's okay to take violent acts towards those who they disagree with. We want students to understand that there's a means by which you can disagree with folks respectfully, and it's through speech and debate. Specifically, this initiative where students are participating across the state, they're learning to engage in that respectful dialogue. They are developing those critical thinking skills. They're growing in the civic virtues that are essential to preserving our constitutional republic. And I said it yesterday, it's not just in textbook form. That's what's so awesome about the speech and debate initiative. They put what they're learning in civics class into action through, evidence-based reasoning, respectful dialogue, the different metrics by which we measure these students. And it's really awesome to see how much growth this initiative that was started by Governor DeSantis a few years back. We had only 59 teams and only 11 school districts in the state who were participating. Now we have more than 330 teams in all 67 of the school districts statewide. So it's great to see the enthusiasm. Of course, we're excited to announce the $50,000 grand prize for the winner, the $25,000 scholarship for the runner-up. The two semifinalists will receive $15,000. And the four quarterfinalists, $10,000, all in scholarships, of course. But this is such a great incentive to now get more participation and buy-in from students. It's also a great way to reward their hard work because these students really give it their all. They take time to prepare and to practice and to give the best presentation they can at the championship, which is going to be hosted at the New College of Florida in April. So it was awesome to have the announcement yesterday at New College of Florida, whose President Richard Corcoran is doing amazing things down there. But we're really excited to see that as a state, yeah, you're going to have some naysayers, but the reality is the vast majority of folks are really positive when it comes to what we're doing with respect to speech and debate. And again, as you put it, this is just one initiative. You know, this governor has prioritized civics at the forefront of education since he came into office, whether it was the civic literacy assessment, whether it's the professional development that educators are receiving related to civics, the civics literacy directors and coaches who are actually out there in the trenches working with teachers and making sure they understand the standards that are within our state, which are rich and robust standards of our nation's history. And you know, you mentioned the Civic Seal of Excellence endorsement. Yes, that's great. It goes on the teacher's certificate and shows that they're essentially an expert in civics. But the biggest appeal for teachers is it comes with a $3,000 bonus. And so it's awesome to see that there are over 20,000 teachers who have benefited as a result of that Civic Seal of Excellence endorsement. And they're not all civics teachers, but it's great that they learn the foundational history of this country, because whether it's in English, whether it's in science, they can still implement those standards when they're providing instruction.
Absolutely. And I love everything that you just said. I mean, this is exactly what every state needs to be doing, because you understand this, Commissioner. Governor DeSantis understands this. Our Lieutenant Governor Jay Collins understands this. You know, as you all speak so robustly about the founding of the country, you know, the principles by which we lead, because even if it's not a government teacher, civics and that foundational view of that shapes our civil society touches and concerns everything that we do in all policy areas. And, you know, this was one of the things that I loved going through law school, was understanding how law and policy really does shape a lot of different industries, and the way that we go about implementing those ideas that then become policy and law ultimately shape a lot of those professions, which then has that effect of shaping how we're able to exercise our God-given freedoms in society. And so this is so important for students to learn and understand. And Florida is taking that initiative in so many different areas. And this really needs to become basically a handbook and a model for how students across the country need to learn. Is there any conversation that you're having with the Secretary of Education on the federal level, Linda McMahon, you know, in terms of maybe doing partnering and having some sort of, federal dollars, there's always the catch, and I get all of that, but maybe having some of those incentives for other states to then implement this, or going directly, you know, just to those states and saying, listen, you know, for all of these reasons, this is why you also need to implement this type of civics program.
Absolutely. We are in constant communication with the U.S. Department of Education. In fact, yesterday, that was another announcement that we were able to launch, celebrating America's 250th anniversary through the U.S. Department of Education's American History and Civics National Activities Grant. Several Florida universities have received funding to promote civic education and first principles learning. This just goes to show leadership's everything. And with Governor Ron DeSantis, he does not rest on his laurels. Every year he wants to see how we are advancing civics education even further. And so with this partnership at the federal level with the U.S. Department of Education, five of our universities have qualified for grants that are going to be implemented in various shapes and forms that are still pushing civics education. Florida State University, for example, received $4.7 million for programs on the Founding Fathers and civic research. Florida International University received $2.9 million to advance education on the American tradition through the Adam Smith Center for Economic Freedom, which anyone who knows anything about the Adam Smith Center, it is so impactful, located in the heart of Miami at FIU, and so many Latin American presidents go and speak. I know they had Javier Milei recently, but it's so important to those countries to see the advantage of economic freedom, where socialism is constantly trying to permeate its ugly head over there. And so they lead at Florida International University through that Adam Smith Center. The University of North Florida was given $2.1 million to enhance civic instruction for 9th through 12th grade teachers. The new College of Florida was given the $1.8 million for its invigorating liberty and self-governance initiative. And then the University of West Florida, my predecessor, former Commissioner of Education Manny Diaz, now president of the University of West Florida, was given the $1.5 million to expand its Summer Institute for Civics Educators into a full-time civics center. So
wow.
I just love that the governor empowers us to go after these initiatives and make sure that civics education in our state doesn't look like a one-size-fits-all approach. It's so unique, it's so regional, and so specific to students. Yes, we have standards statewide that are being implemented, but we also have all these amazing programs to push.
Amazing. Well, we got it ended there, but I think we're going to see a lot of elected officials come out of the state of Florida, so really appreciate it, Commissioner.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
Preborn's whole mission is to rescue babies from abortion and lead their families to Christ. Last year, Preborn's network of clinics saw 8,900 mothers come to Christ. Please join us in this life-saving mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.